Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your ultimate window into the kitchens of the world's best cooks. I'm your host, Kara Rhoda. In the next few podcast episodes, we'll be highlighting the authors of the first few books in a very special series of cookbooks, Cookster Classics. Cookster Classics is a series collaboration between Cookster and Picador. It brings to the forefront some of the most beloved cookbooks of the last decades, with recipes and techniques that today's chefs continue to draw from again and again. Presenting these beloved, enduring titles in their original form, with the recipes and headnotes just as they were written decades ago, preserves a unique piece of food history while reminding us just how relevant these masterfully crafted cookbooks are to a new generation of home cooks. New forwards champion what made each Cookster Classic such an important cookbook when first published and why each is well worth rediscovering. Cooking in a Small Kitchen, originally published in 1979, is Arthur Schwartz's first cookbook, written while he was the assistant food editor at Long Island Newsday. He then became executive food editor, columnist, and restaurant critic for the New York Daily News. He went on to write six more cookbooks, all of which were nominated for or won prestigious awards and presided over an award-winning daily food talk program, the first in the country. He continues to broadcast and podcast on the NPR affiliate Robin Hood Radio. Arthur, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm so excited to talk with you about this book because it is one that feels so relevant to our lives still today. You begin Cooking in a Small Kitchen by decrying all the pitfalls of a generously sized kitchen and why it's actually awful to have to cook in one of them. Why do you believe a small kitchen is more ideal for the home cook?
Well, now that I'm older, 40 years older, I really appreciate a small kitchen because you don't have to walk a lot. You just stand in one place and everything is there. And I am back to having, after having an absolutely enormous kitchen at one time in my life, I'm back to having a small kitchen. I live in an apartment in Brooklyn. It's a rather large apartment. And for New York kitchen, it's totally ample. I actually have a place by a window overlooking gardens that I can sit at.
I feel like the window in a kitchen is a huge luxury.
Oh, it's a great luxury, Kara, is having a window and a table to sit at in the kitchen. I don't serve friends. Well, I do. We can fit three at the table. In any case, I don't mind having a small kitchen. I have the luxury of having a pantry kitchen, a second kitchen in my apartment that I can store all my stuff. I think you need a big kitchen more to store stuff. Although when I had a really small kitchen, but let's start with the kitchen that I was cooking in at the time I wrote Cooking in a Small Kitchen.
And I have to ask, on the original cover of the book, there's that photo. Is that your kitchen?
That is my kitchen. It wasn't as small as it, you know, I don't know. It was small enough. It had no dishwasher and had no counter space. So I bought a portable dishwasher with a butcher block top, and that was my mobile kitchen island. And when the dishes needed to be done, you pushed it over to the sink and you hooked it up to the sink with tubes. And when otherwise, you were there. So the picture on the back of the book, is that going to be on the back of the new book? I haven't seen it, no. So the picture, besides that I look young and fit and thin in that picture, that really is my a kitchen. And unfortunately, the things you see in that picture, like you're from New Jersey. You may know about this. Renault wine was a big New Jersey wine.
Sure.
So I had a poster from Renault wine and some other precious things to me. And they were all stolen in a burglary done by my landlady who harassed me out of the apartment because she knew she could rent it for a lot more than what I was paying. It was a fabulous little apartment in Greenwich Village. In any case, I got that apartment and that kitchen because I was friends with James Beard. And that's, I would say, I'm going to surprise you. But I got divorced. I moved into a sublet, I must say, which did not have a small kitchen, but it was only for a year and a half, in West Beth, which is a building on the far west side of Manhattan that used to be a phone company laboratory building, but then became converted in the late 60s to artists and writers' residence. So I was a poor, starving writer at the time, and I was able to get in. But when I wasn't starving anymore, they threw me out, and I had to find a real apartment. By that time, I was friends with James Beard, who lived in the village. And I called him and said, oh, you know, this is a problem because I can't find an apartment with a, you know, an adequate kitchen. And he totally understood this. He put me in touch with a friend of his who was a real estate broker. And she said, well, I have the apartment for you, but it's not a public on the market. I'm just doing this for a friend. Well, the friend was a woman in her 80s, a very well-known publicist. She was Martha Graham's publicist. She sort of created modern dance. She was very infirm. She lived on the garden floor, and I lived on the parlor floor. And it was fabulous for a few years while it lasted, until the daughter harassed me out of the apartment. So those pans, I still have the exact same pans that are in that picture. There were three copper pans that I bought at Delorean in Paris when I was very young. And after they were stolen, years later, I went to Paris with my mother, and we went to Delorean. She said, didn't you used to have pans from, I said, yeah, and she bought them for me again. So I still have them. I still use them all the time.
I love that, because my next question was going to be about, you know, when you have a small kitchen, obviously space is at a premium. So we're not going to have all of those many, many appliances that someone who lives in the Midwest
Forget appliances.
Suburbs might have.
I am now living without a food processor because my almost new food processor died on me. And I'm realizing, you know, people lived before they had food processors. So I'm not going to make quenelle. You know, there aren't many things you can't do. I have a lot of stuff, a lot of pots, but you don't need a lot. And I think, as I wrote in Cooking in a Small Kitchen, if you have a, you know, black iron skillet, or two or three would be even better. They're very cheap. I still cook in my black iron all the time, even though I have tons of copper and I use my copper all the time too. A wooden spoon, a spatula. There aren't that many things you have to have. And when you have a small kitchen, you've got to pare things down just for storage purposes, although you could always take over the whole coat closet with your kitchen stuff. The other thing is not just the space, but you don't need that much counter space. And even when I had this vast kitchen in a country house, and I built this kitchen, and it was pretty efficient, I still found I use the same 3 feet between the sink and the stove. And even now, I renovated my kitchen a few years ago, and I have 12 running feet of counter space. I still use that same 3 feet between the stove and the sink. You don't need much more than that. And I still use my sink as sort of a garbage can, I have to say. And I don't have a disposal, but I throw everything in the sink, and then I just clear out the sink.
I love that. And I feel like throughout the book, you managed to make really beautiful, really complex, really interesting dishes with not much space and not much.
You know, I don't know if they're complex. I had wanderlust when I was young. Mm-hmm. And even I was only 30 when I wrote that book. I had traveled through Europe already more than once, and with an eye on food and wine. So I came home from trips always with new ideas that they weren't new in the world. They were just new to me. And I liked that international kitchen. So the book reflects that. And in fact, when you called me to say that you were going to make it part of this classic cookbook series, I started cooking things from which I haven't cooked in many years. And the only thing, besides that, ingredients have changed. I wrote my big Italian book, Naples at Table, in the mid-90s. And even from the mid-90s, ingredients have changed. But back to 1969, for instance, canned tomatoes used to only come with juice in the can. Now they're almost all packed with puree. So whereas I say, you know, drain the can of tomatoes, you don't have to do that anymore. And my baking techniques have improved vastly since I was 30 years old. And so some of the cakes, although I've tried a few of the cakes and they work, I would mix them a little differently. Like when a recipe says add one egg at a time to the beginning of a batter, you know, you really have to beat those eggs into the batter for a good full minute. It's not just a matter of throwing an egg in, you know, mixing it in. And no, if you want the cake to rise correctly and have the right texture crumb, you really have to beat those eggs in very well. So little things like that have changed, but
What, if anything, do you feel has changed about the way that Americans cook since 1979 when this book first came out?
Well, I think they're back to cooking the way I cooked in 1979, very eclectic. In those days, you know, I collect cookbooks myself, and you could see how cuisine was changing over the 70s and 80s by what cookbooks were being published. When I first started 40 years ago, more actually, it's almost 50 years ago, there were very few cookbooks, American, in quotes, cookbooks. Then there was a boom. 1972, I think it was, James Beard published his big American cookbook, and that started the ball rolling. And then there were all these general American cookbooks and then regional American cookbooks. So from having maybe a half a shelf of American cookbooks in 1970, I ended up having a whole bookcase full by the end of the 80s. Then there was the Indian period. I can't tell you in the 1990s how many – one of the books in your series is an Indian cookbook. I don't know what year it was published, but my guess is somewhere in the mid to late 80s. It is 70s.
Yeah.
Well, they were.
But you know what?
She was ahead of her time.
It was a UK cookbook originally.
Okay.
So I think they are a little bit generally.
Well, they had a lot more Indian immigrants than we did at that period. So it also follows immigration, too. So we have a lot more Mexican, Latin American, and then those flavors, which were borrowed by a lot of American chefs who maybe they even grew up in the Southwest. And they grew up eating those flavors. But a great example of not is Bobby Flay, who grew up in New York and totally made up a cuisine to serve on the Lower East Side at the Miracle Grill. And it was kind of Latin flavored. But so that didn't happen, though, until the 80s.
What trends do you see now in the cookbook market and in the restaurant world?
You know, I'm detached from that. I've crawled back into my own space now that I don't have to have a full-time job anymore. And I am on the radio, and what I do is I talk about what I've been cooking that week. I cook almost every day. I finked out to lunch today, and I regretted it. But I am going to go home later to a home-cooked meal that I cooked this morning. So, you know, I laugh at a lot of the trends because I know that, you know, people like they get obsessed with some new ingredient that I know is going to disappear in 2 years or be so overused or misused that nobody's going to care about it anymore. Case in point, balsamic vinegar, although that has stuck with us, unfortunately. That's one of those things that people went crazy with in the 90s, balsamic vinegar. Everything was balsamic vinegar. I'll tell you a trend that really troubles me, well, more than one. Sweet flavors in everything. Now, you cannot escape. Just the other day, I was listening. I was at Whole Foods, and there was a cookbook author there doing a book signing, and he doesn't call it vegan cuisine, but it is more or less vegan. I'm not sure what the less part is. It's vegan. And I looked through his cookbook. Every recipe had maple syrup in it. And then he has a whole chapter on how bad sugar is for you. Doesn't he understand that maple syrup is sugar? That honey is sugar? So sugar in everything, at the same time that we're decrying the use of sugar. The other thing is, if you watch food TV, which I don't really, but I flip through the stations and there you get something that catches your eye. I don't know, food TVs will become all about gross out hamburgers. It's like, how much crap can we put on one bun at the same time that we're complaining about America, the way America eats? Yeah, it's true that if you eat processed food, you're worse off than if you eat from scratch food. But if you see what they're making from scratch on TV, you would be dead way before your time.
Before we continue, a quick word from one of our Clever Cookster podcast sponsors. Everyone has a family member who tells the best stories. StoryWorth makes it easy and fun for your loved ones to share their stories. Simply purchase a subscription for someone you love, and each week, StoryWorth emails them a question about their life. They reply with their story, either via email, on the web, or in the app, and after a year, their stories are bound into a beautiful hardcover book. Data is always secure and private by default, so you never have to worry about a thing. It's a great way to learn about your family, no matter how far away they may be. With StoryWorth, families can easily pass down memories to future generations and know that their children will remember. StoryWorth makes a great last-minute and unique memorable gift for Mother's Day or Father's Day. For $20 off when you subscribe, visit StoryWorth.com/clever. That's StoryWorth.com/clever. And now, back to our podcast.
It feels very much, and maybe we're shifting out of this a bit, but it feels very much that there's this sort of extreme polarization. We're either sort of talking about, really healthy, clean eating, this sort of purity of eating very few things that are supposedly good for you and focusing on those superfoods versus the sort of excess of bacon on everything.
Bacon on everything. Yeah. Well, isn't that over now?
I hope so. I love bacon, but I love it on its own.
Well, I love bacon for its own sake. Well, that's a trend. Back fat. I somehow stumbled over a demo on the internet to make a porchetta. And actually, it was cleverly done. I'm a big fan of porchetta. And this was very well done. But it's fat. It was just basically rolled up bacon with seasoning. And I could have a slice. That's, by the way, not really what porchetta is.
What are some of your favorite recipes in this book? As you went back to it, what were some of the ones that you went back to and were excited to rediscover?
Well, the one that I've made several times now, let me just say, I'm diabetic. Not severely, but on the edge enough that I'm careful. So only in the last few years have I discovered that chocolate is a great sweet for diabetics. You can actually buy 78% Lindt, it has almost no carbs at all. It's so unsweetened. So I have made several times now what we call in the book, I call in the book, mock mousse, because it's not real chocolate mousse the way I learned from Julia Child. The word mousse, as every hairstylist knows, means foam. And truthfully, when you order chocolate mousse these days, it's rarely foam. It's mostly dense.
It's mostly pudding.
It's like pudding, right. Or pot au creme. It can be more refined and say pot au creme or custard. Whatever. This one is a super easy recipe. You just beat the egg yolks with add the melted chocolate and then fold in egg whites. There's really nothing to it. The mistake I made when I made the recipe the first time, this is absolutely as written in the book, is that I'd forgotten that I also suggest you serve it at room temperature. And it is too dense out of the refrigerator. Doesn't mean it stopped me from picking at it.
I love that.
Did I make? There was one of the cakes. I wish I had the book in front of me. One of the cakes I've been making, I made a couple times. It's very nostalgic, some of these recipes. And some of these things I haven't stopped making. I may make them hummus. In 1970, the book was published in 69, was finished in 1968. Hummus was not unheard of, but it definitely was not. They didn't have whole sections of the dairy case filled with hummus. If you wanted it, you had to make it or go to one of the few Middle Eastern restaurants that were around. I learned to cook at home from a grandmother. My mother was a very good cook, but she didn't like to do it very much. My grandmother cooked all the time. But then when I went to work for Newsday, I was only 22. I had a really great journalism education, I realized today. I realized then, actually, too. I had a very practical education. And I didn't have any food education. But my job at Newsday was to go around and interview people and get recipes from them. And so I visited grandmothers of every persuasion on Long Island. And I would say I learned to cook from hundreds of grandmothers. So that is another reason why the recipes in the book and cooking in a small kitchen are so eclectic. Because, this gado-gado in there, I've made that recently. That's an Indonesian vegetable salad with a peanut dressing. We must have had some Filipinos living on Long Island that taught me that. Strudel. There's no strudel recipe in the book, but I did learn how to make strudel in those days. From very stern Hungarian grandmothers.
What are the things that you think make this book still so relevant today, or the things that people have told you make them keep going back to it?
Since this book was written, America has been exposed to chef cooking on television. And there is now more than one generation, probably including yours, that think that if they're not making chef food, they're not cooking. People tell me all the time, oh, I don't cook. I said, well, what do you eat? Do you order in? Do you go out to eat? What do you do? Well, I can broil some lamb chops and make a vegetable. And I said, well, that's cooking. So cooking in a small kitchen is simple food for home cooks. It's not chef food, although some of it you could probably plate to make it look like chef food. And thing that keeps coming back to me to show you, it's a practical book. Valentine's Day, which has now become a big eating out day, it wasn't in 1969. People actually cooked for their lovers in those days. But who wanted to be stuck in the kitchen? Blah, blah. So I remember there's a Valentine's Day dinner in there where everything is made ahead, including veal chops. I keep meaning to recreate that.
Well, now might be the time with your new edition.
Yeah, maybe. Also, oh, here's one. Here's a memorable meal. There's a ham steak baked in milk. And along with that, I served, this was a show-off meal for me in those days because I had friends who were wine writers, wine experts, and I made this ham steak with spoon bread. It was a lunch. They lived across the street. And I served it with German wines, showing off that I could pair this American food with that actually was a very memorable meal. And I have done that one again. I've made the spoon bread. I've made the ham. I made the ham. It's hard. Now, here's one. It's hard to get a ham steak the way I did in 1969. They're all now full of sugar and water. It's hard to get like a really good piece of ham. I think you probably have to go to a butcher.
Arthur, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today.
My pleasure, really.
It's such a fantastic book, and I'm so glad that it's coming out now again for a new audience, Cooking in a Small Kitchen by Arthur Schwartz. And tune in next time on The Clever Cookster for more tips and tricks from the kitchens of the world's best cooks.